As a nation begins to turn the corner on vaccinations, President Biden signs a $1.9 trillion pandemic rescue package. We explore the potential economic impact on this edition of Iowa Press.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa PBS Foundation, the Associated General Contractors of Iowa, the public's partner in building Iowa's highway, bridge, and municipal utility infrastructure.
Iowa PBS is supported in part by Wells Fargo. Fuel Iowa is a voice and a resource for Iowa's fuel industry. Our members offer a diverse range of products, including fuel, grocery, and convenience items. They help keep Iowans on the move in rural and urban communities. Together, we fuel Iowa.
Small businesses are the backbone of Iowa's communities, and they are backed by Iowa banks. With advice, loans, and financial services, banks across Iowa are committed to showing small businesses the way to a stronger tomorrow. Learn more at iowabankers.com. For decades, Iowa Press has brought you politicians and newsmakers from across Iowa and beyond. Celebrating nearly 50 years of broadcast excellence on statewide Iowa PBS. This is the Friday, March 12 edition of Iowa Press. Here is Kay Henderson.
What a year. A global pandemic. President Biden has just signed into law a $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. What will the economic impact be? Joining us to discuss today are Ernie Goss, director of the Institute of Economic Inquiry and an economics professor at Creighton University, and David Swenson, a research scientist in the Iowa State University Department of Economics. Gentlemen, welcome to Iowa Press.
Thanks, Kay.
Thank you.
Across the table, Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio and Aaron Murphy of the Lee Enterprises newspapers.
Gentlemen, Kay mentioned the stimulus package that's going to be, as soon as this weekend, putting checks in people's bank accounts. Do we have any evidence, and Ernie, we'll start with you, of where that money is spent based on past stimuluses? Does that money go into the economy? Do people catch up on back bills? Do they put it in their savings? Where does that money go?
In advance, I'll say it's the wrong package at the wrong time. But not to answer your question, though, that it's a lot. 40% will be saved. Now, that, in other words, of that going to individuals. And that last time, 70% was saved. So there will be a lot of it going in. And unfortunately, it's going in some of the wrong spots, in my view. $350 billion going to state and local governments. In other words, bailing out those entities that have overspent and taken bad lockdown actions that were counterproductive. So there was $40 billion going to some of the universities. I don't think that's a good expenditure. It'd be hard for me to identify anything in the much. There's some portions of the package support for child care, I think, is very good, but others, I just think there's a lot of waste and. It won't be like, remember President Obama's shovel ready. And even President Obama, the last time I heard him utter the words, he even laughed at shovel ready. It wasn't shovel ready. It didn't get to the ground. This is more likely to get to where it's needed, or I would say it will be spent. But again, on the individual level, 70% will be saved or pay off debt.
A couple of things that you talked about we're going to come back to. But first, David, is the same thing. Where will most of this money wind up going?
Well, I want to preface with it's the right act at the right time. Actually, it's long overdue. There has been a lot of pain that's been endured over the last 6 months since the last parts of the last stimulus bill ran out, then the dithering of Congress. There has been a lot of inaction and a lot of uncertainty. And so this bill right now was important and it's needed, and it's going to cover a wide range of categories that haven't been addressed specifically well over the course of the first two pandemic reliefs, in my opinion.
Such as what?
First of all, it has a very highly detailed set of activities in terms of promoting the pandemic response with regard to vaccines and preparation. So along those categories, it has several categories also, again, for dealing with businesses that are stressed, restaurants, dining and drinking establishments especially, another big chunk of money, $25 billion, I believe, for severely stressed businesses. A lot of assistance also has been put up for rental assistance, targeted specifically for back rent, people who are in arrears with regard to their rent. So what it is dealing with for many people is a lot of the distress that they've been enduring. Ernie also said, though, that he says a lot of this money is going to be saved, but the allocation, especially with the addition of the child care, the child tax credit component of it, actually makes the flow of these funds into households highly progressive. It raises their incomes for the lowest income people, lowers their ultimate taxes, federal taxes, for those groups as well.
I was speaking of the $1,400, not the child care credit.
Is the child care credit one area that you both seem to agree that that is a good thing?
Yes.
So let's move to a lot of states and local governments are going to be receiving money with this package. How does that money get spent well, in your opinion? We'll start with you, Ernie.
The $350 billion you're referring
correct.
To. Correct. Well, one of the problems is I use a good economic term, crazy. I mean, in other words, it's allocated according to the unemployment rate at the end of the year. Now, could that make sense to anyone other than a state that's been in lockdown, making bad decisions, such as California is getting about $40 billion, New York's getting $25 billion. I will probably get about $2.5 billion. Why? Because the unemployment rate in Iowa and Nebraska have been low. It should have been, if you're going to allocate it on a failed statistic, a bad statistic, it should have been a change of unemployment rate, not the unemployment rate.
Dave, would you use that same economic term as of crazy?
Well, no, I'm not going to go to crazy, but I'm not sure. The unemployment rate, it seems to me that they should have had a multi-factor allocating formula. But to get to Ernie's point about the unemployment rate, we had states that did go into lockdown, like Vermont, that has the same unemployment rate as Iowa right now. The unemployment rate with regard to overall economic performance and the pandemic is not necessarily highly correlated.
Well, at the same time, too, the unemployment rate, I remember during the Great Recession, a lot of Midwest rural states, it might not have been the best way to measure unemployment. We're seeing less participation in the workforce. Is the unemployment rate a proper way to measure the economic strength of a state?
Let me jump in. I've done this research here for Iowa. First of all, they've had some revisions in our unemployment rate. The state's reporting it at 3.1% as of last week, though the revisions have boosted it up to 3.7%. Iowa's unemployment rate is significantly lower than we would have anticipated because of really large exits from the workforce. Over this period of time, about 68% of the improvement in the unemployment rate since April, when it was the highest, has been due to people leaving the labor force. And the rest of it is because of people coming back into the labor force or improving in employment. And so the unemployment rate, we've got problems with the workforce. And the pandemic has damaged the workforce. Iowa is moving atypically with regard to its labor supply than the national experience. The national experience, when employment went up, the labor force went up as well. In Iowa, when employment went up in May, June, July, and August, our labor force kept going down and then stayed down. So we've got some issues that have to be dealt with. And so as a consequence, I'm arguing we have somewhat of an artificially low unemployment rate. And I'm back to that point. We should have used, or we would be nicer if we had some sort of multi-factor allocation.
But even if you're going to use the unemployment rate, which is, we do both agree it's a bad statistic. But you should have used the change in the unemployment rate between February and the seasonally adjusted unemployment rate, February and today. And that why reward states that have made, in my judgment, I disagree, the lockdown states have made huge mistakes. It's been a huge mistake. You compare Florida's experience versus New York's experience. Death rates and infection rates about the same, yet the economic performance of Florida is significantly above New York's.
What about the exit from the workforce? Do you see that as a problem for states like Iowa?
Absolutely, but it's a problem for all states. But as Dave said, it has been more of an issue for this part of the country. The exit participation rates here are in this part of the country are usually higher, mm-hmm. and you will get more exits and reducing the participation rate back to the U.S. level. So you will get those. So you do what we call discouraged workers, and that's one of the, as Dave said, it should have been a multi-factor methodology. But if you're going to use the unemployment rate, use the change in unemployment rate. This is not complex. We had 30 in the states of North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, 33 representatives that voted on this bill, or voted on the bill. Only four voted for it. So you get an idea about how folks in this part of the country see the bill, in my judgment. And our surveys indicate that the economy here was, back to the point, the economy here was already rebounding. I mean, in other words, the president is going to be able to claim credit for something that was already in place. This economy is moving ahead right now, and manufacturing, agriculture looking much better. So, again, I don't agree.
So what happens when you inject $2 trillion into the economy?
We call that inflation. And inflation, the numbers released just today on the producer price index was unbelievably strong. Now, it's not going to be rampant inflation, but the inflation rate is going to be rising, and we've already seen it. The CPI this month went up 0.4%, or last month, 0.4%. We'll multiply that by 12, that's 4.8%. That's well above the target for the Federal Reserve.
David, do you share that concern where this is at least the third big stimulus? Are we pumping too much money into the economy?
Well, that's the classic or the orthodox argument. It remains to be seen. We've had that complaint or that worry over the last 15 years. We've had absolutely no out of control inflation. We've consistently underperformed the Fed's target with regard to inflation. And if anything, there was the lament that perhaps inflation needed to be higher over a pre-pandemic because basically we were underperforming. Now, will this do that? A lot of economists disagree with Ernie, including me, that this is probably not going to be that inflationary. It very well in the short run create a higher demand for a wide range of goods and services. But in the longer run, I don't think that we need to be worrying about inflation right now. We need to be worrying about getting the economy broadly back into a healthy place with a healthy workforce, and then we can make policy decisions from then on.
Let's talk about the health of the ag economy. Professor Goss, there's some concern that there's a cliff out there, because the Trump administration advanced subsidies to farmers to compensate for trade losses. Is there going to be some sort of cliff effect if the Biden administration doesn't continue those subsidies?
Well, as everyone knows, there's not an Iowa caucus this year. So we're talking about the federal government's involvement in the agricultural economy in terms of support. The support payments are going to be much lower this year. But even with that, we're seeing an agricultural economy. You're talking about corn is about $2 a bushel higher today than it was, a year ago. So the farm economy is moving ahead. We're talking about exports growing, soybean, now on soybean, corn, wheat doing much better. Now on the livestock side, not as much. But when the back to Dave's point about when the restaurants return around, when we see some growth there, then we'll see beef increasing with restaurant sales. So I don't see a cliff. I see some movement in the positive direction. Agriculture, according to our surveys of bank CEOs in 10 states, including Iowa, looks very good. Agricultural farmland prices are growing. Farmers are buying more equipment now than they were before. So we're seeing the best ag economy since 2013 and 14.
Professor, should the subsidies end?
Well, the subsidies have to end. The market facilitation payments were based on the trade actions. The trade actions, one way or the other, are going to roll back. As Ernie just said, prices have improved. Farmers are doing well. If we look at the statistics, I've done some analysis. Ernie's right. They're in better shape than they've been since 2013. Actually, they're above the decade's average in terms of annual aggregate income, just as of the third quarter of 2020. So you know, a lot of that improvement is because of subsidies. And by the way, this new pandemic relief bill had $10.4 billion in it for agriculture. So they're certainly not being weaned off cold turkey here. But there is subsidy available for them, and they're in better shape.
At the outset of the pandemic, there was a lot of concern about economic pain for Midwest states like Iowa for their state government budgets. Doesn't seem to be panning out quite that way. Is that the federal stimulus doing its job? Is it delaying the pain? Where do we stand with state government budgets here right now?
The state government budgets, what we've seen thus far, are pretty good. And that's true across the nation. In other words, we looked at what was going on in the stimulus programs and what we were seeing. And Clay, that's where I don't think the $350 billion, perhaps it is needed by some of the local governments, but overall the state government budgets are reasonably sound right now. And the governors, and back to my point, or back to a point, is we're rewarding bad behavior. In my judgment, governors that have locked down their states, and I'll pick on Governor Cuomo. I mean, no one else is picking on him now, and so I'll pick on him and Governor Newsom. They locked it down, and that really caused some real problems. And it caused it really hurt the national economy when you're talking about states like Illinois, Chicago, more so. So, yeah.
And I disagree. The lockdowns were necessary at a time of extraordinary uncertainty.
Show me where that had any impact on the infection rates or the death rates. I don't see it.
There were different dynamics. What happened in New York and what happened in New Jersey early on was this incredible amount of uncertainty, and they did not know what else to do, and were following the European example, and were trying to just work their way through an incredible crisis that nobody understood. So I don't agree.
Aaron?
So one of the, because state governments are in a decent position, including in Iowa here, Republicans were considering tax cuts. Now, because of some potential strings with the federal relief money, they might not be able to do that. Is that a bad thing? What's the implication of that, Ernie, if a state government can't go through with planned tax cuts because of federal relief money?
Well, Aaron, I think that's reasonable to take a cautious approach. Back to Kay's point about the cliff. I mean, there are some real dangers out there, so I would be more cautious regarding that. But if you look at what's what's going on, I mean, we're talking the federal government. We're now hearing the Biden administration talking about a tax increase. Now, when is the last time you heard an economist talking about stimulating the economy and slowing it down at the same time? Tax increases will slow the economy down. Now we're getting a stimulus. The two don't work together. And the stimulus that we're going to see, we're going to now see an infrastructure program plus a tax increase. And back to I don't want to let this one go, the inflation number, look at the yield on the 10-year Treasury. It's up over the last 3 months by 0.8%. That's an inflation increase right there. So inflation is well above what we would like to see.
David, is now the time to be cutting state taxes?
Well, no. First of all, not in Iowa. Iowa has relatively low taxes. The costs of government in Iowa are comparatively low. Our overall tax system isn't an impediment to investment or overall performance. So no, I don't think so. I think what we are as a GOP-run state, and cutting taxes is one of the items on their agenda, and that's what they're going to pursue so long as they have power to do that.
But I do think it's a time for caution in regard to tax cuts at the state and local level. There's too much uncertainty out there. Nebraska's doing some of the same things, and I'm like, I'd like to see how this plays out, especially with impending tax increase. We've got a senator from Oregon talking about taxing unrealized gain on stocks. Now, where did that come from? Well, it's not sane. That's insane.
Professor Swenson, one thing that was removed from the American Rescue Plan was a proposed increase in the federal minimum wage. What should the federal minimum wage be in Iowa? In Iowa and nationally?
For one, it needs to be much above $7.25
So is $15 the right?
Well, we have to put the $15 into perspective. First of all, $15 was a goal over several years, three, four, 5 years, to reach that $15 point from the enactment period. The minimum wage, just adjusted for inflation, for Iowa, if it's $7.25, if we'd have just adjusted it for inflation, would be somewhere north of $9, or maybe a little bit more. So the minimum wage needs to be improved, both at the federal level and at the state level. And the minimum wage needs to be indexed to inflation so that we stop having it be a political football where we create a lot of either misery or underperformance with regard to the labor force as a consequence of an artificially low minimum wage. Yes, we have businesses out there, the market wage is higher, but we still have a substantial fraction of people that have to work at that minimum wage.
Ernie Goss?
I agree with much of what Dave said, except the problem with the teenagers, you need a sub-minimum wage for teenagers. At least I remember when I was not worth $7.25 an hour. Perhaps that's still the case. But
just a quick follow-up on that topic. I'd like to hear from you both. We always hear that from business interests, especially, that when you raise the minimum wage, it's going to actually destroy jobs.
Right.
Is there data on that? You guys study this.
I'll start. First off, it goes both ways. It depends on who's doing the research and where the research is being done and the questions that are being asked. Generally speaking, and we have recent information on this, is that it tends to increase permanent employment, but it also decreases employment. It increases spending for one group of households, but again, because it makes employment harder for some people, it pushes some people out of the labor force. Also, increasing the minimum wage has a multiplier effect in that it pushes up the wages of those just above it as well. So it has relatively positive effect. Does it destroy jobs? The shorter answer is it probably does. Are the gains greater than the losses? They may be.
One thing we need to think about, though, is what is the market wage? In other words, setting it above the market wage is what we're really concerned about. When you set it above the market wage, as Dave said, there is evidence of job losses. But right now, the number one issue for businesses, manufacturers, small businesses that we survey, the big issue is finding and hiring qualified workers. So they're bidding up the wage right now well above the minimum wage for manufacturers. Now, in some of the food services, there we're talking about an industry that has been hammered, and their ability to... I'm concerned about raising the minimum wage there for an industry that is in trouble right now.
Big picture, to wrap things up, long term, how has the pandemic forever changed the economy, Dave?
Oh, wow. First off, it has destroyed a lot of businesses. It has changed a lot of business sectors in terms of where their relative position is, and it's going to take a long time for them to recover. It's also affected the workforce. I have been working in my living room for 9 months. I think that there are a lot of people now that their relationship to the economy, where they work and how they work and what they do, is going to change a lot. And the other thing that it does, it's demonstrated how vulnerable our economy and our society is to an absence of preparation to some kind of disaster of this magnitude.
Professor Goss?
I think our industry, that's education, has been dramatically affected, and particularly in K through 12, the ability to teach online versus in person. And we found out that online, there are really a lot of limitations there. But in going forward, we have this hybrid approach, which is going to be very strong and very good for everybody when we can serve different populations, different groups, and provide them with good, sound education. Now, on the negative side, I think local government has not responded very well. I don't think they've embraced technology. A lot of us, we've tried. You go down to your county seat and try to get some things done. They're not there. They're sealed up. You have to call, get an appointment. The government has not responded very well. I would say those of us in education those of us that have responded well are going to do well. Those that haven't are going to be out of business.
Another big question, big picture question. We have just more than a minute left. What was the biggest economic mistake that you saw? Ernie, you talked about the lockdowns. Anything other than that, as you watched officials handle the pandemic response?
Oh, there were a heck of a lot of mistakes. One, back in the Trump administration, CDC was making economic policy. CDC said that, and I don't give medical advice. They shouldn't give economic advice. They were saying an eviction moratorium, a moratorium on evictions for renters. Well, how does that make sense? Nobody would agree that a renter that doesn't have it in September is not going to have it in January. Who's going to pay that landlord? And the answer is no one. So that's one bad step.
In mind, it's the absence of timely follow-up after the first pandemic relief activity, that they dithered, that they waited, that it became political rather than functional with regard to the pain that was being realized, especially during the worst of the pandemic.
Gentlemen, we are out of time on this edition of Iowa Press. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Kay.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Aaron, Clay.
And thanks to you at home for watching. For everyone here at Iowa PBS, have a good weekend.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa PBS Foundation, the Associated General Contractors of Iowa, the public's partner in building Iowa's highway, bridge, and municipal utility infrastructure.
Iowa PBS is supported in part by Wells Fargo. Fuel Iowa is a voice and a resource for Iowa's fuel industry. Our members offer a diverse range of products, including fuel, grocery, and convenience items. They help keep Iowans on the move in rural and urban communities. Together, we fuel Iowa.
Small businesses are the backbone of Iowa's communities, and they are backed by Iowa banks. With advice, loans, and financial services, banks across Iowa are committed to showing small businesses the way to a stronger tomorrow. Learn more at iowabankers.com.